use for sure.
Okay, great. Thank you, everybody, for coming. And thank you to Rabbi Shane for opening up the Merkaz Yeshua. Thank you to Ali Ansahabi, whose idea this was, and for organizing everything. So the purpose, my name is Yossi Bronstein, as I'm sure you're aware, and the purpose of this little mini-story is to be an introduction to Rav Kook's thoughts. And generally speaking, when people think about Rav Kook, they think about Zionism, they think about loving all Jews, they think about a lot of very good things. What we're going to try to do in this series is to show, or just to demonstrate, that Rav Kook was doing a lot more things than that. Zionism was a ramification of some of the other deeper trends in his thought. Loving all Jews was a ramification, was an outgrowth, a derivative of some of the deeper, more fundamental parts of his thought. Try to identify what those things are, why Rav Kook thought they were so important, and why Rav Kook felt they were so important, particularly in the early 20th century, during his own time period. Please feel free to chime in. It's not a class. I'm not going to call on people. But if anybody has any comments or questions, please feel free. So first, today, we're not really going to get into Rav Kook's philosophy, per se. It's more an introduction to Rav Kook himself as a person. And it's mostly going to be in first person. I mean, it's going to be Rav Kook's own diary entries, trying to figure himself out, his own self-description. But before we get there, just a brief biography of Rav Kook. Who was he? When did he live? What did he do? He was born in 1865 in Latvia, somewhere in Northern Europe, and he stood out as a young child, as a child prodigy. Source number one is a story recorded by Simcha Raz in his book, An Angel Among Men. Right, the boy Avram Yitzhak invented a new game in order to entertain himself and his friends in Cheder. He was 6 years old when this story took place, apparently. During the break, the small children would set themselves up in rows with their bags on their shoulders, as if they were preparing to go on a long journey. And he, little Avram Lokka, would conduct them. They would ask each other, "To where are we going?" And he would respond, "To Eretz Yisrael." His face shined happily. What do we see from the story? Assuming it's true, what do we see from the story? He loved Eretz Yisrael as a young kid. He was a natural leader, and he was charismatic. People were attracted to him, even at a very young age. He was born into a mixed family. His father was learned in Velazhe, and his mother came from a Chabad family. He worked with his father as a young boy. He quickly outgrew his father, basically, and his father hired private tutors to teach him. Each of these private tutors had, in addition to being an expert in Gemara and Halakha, had a unique side to them. One of them was a student, was a Mr. student, was a student of a student of Rasul Salanter. Another one was a Shtickle of a Makobo. A third one was a Bucky and a Maharal. In addition, he had an uncle who he used to hang out with from time to time, who was a Shtickle of a Frum Maskil, who had Hebrew and Yiddish translations of Western philosophy in his library. It's like the Sparknotes version in Yiddish, so Jews in Eastern Europe can become familiar with the Kant and Hegel and other such things that were going on. He had a pretty well-rounded education, even though he never had a formal secular education. At age, I think, 17 or 18, he entered Velazhen, which was the mother of all yeshivas. He was one of the youngest students there. And there he stood out there as unique. He was one of the few students there who grew a beard. He was bearded even there. He wore tefillin while he was learning morning seder. The Netziv, Rashi Velazhen, let him wear tefillin when he was learning morning seder, which was unique. And the Netziv also used to send students who had sfikos and hashkafa, hoshela shaylos and amuna, to talk to Rav Kook. Rav Kook was known as not just being somebody who learned 16, 17 hours a day, shas and poskim, but he had a little bit of a broader perspective, and the Netziv used to send students to him.
At what age was he serving in this?
He was 17, 18. And he was in Velazhen for 1 year. He was already engaged to the daughter of the Adaret. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who was a Koreshiva with the Netziv, told people to stay away from the Avraham with the wild eyes. You can see the picture over here. His eyes are a little bit wild. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik didn't really approve of all these aberrations of Rav Kook. The Netziv took him under his wing, and Rav Kook considered the Netziv his Rebbe as much as he had a single Rebbe. This story, in source number two, is recorded by Yitzhak Mirsky. Professor Yitzhak Mirsky got his PhD in Harvard in Rav Kook. He published a biography. This is from his dissertation, which I have a PDF of. The biography he published afterwards, which is based on his dissertation, I don't have access to right now, but the same story appears there. And he's in the process of publishing a second book, and of Cook's early life and thought, I think. So this is an interesting story. Bengis is Reuven Bengis. Zelig Reuven Bengis, who became the head of Edah Haredes in the beginning of the State of Israel, after Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. Bengis noticed that young Cook would, during his Talmud study, repeatedly glance down at some papers on a shelf of a study stand. This is generally a sign that a student was stealing glances at masculine literature or newspapers. Bengis reported his fears in the Nesiv, told him to leave Rav Cook alone, saying he's a tzaddik. The Nesiv was sending students who had Srikos and Amunah. This is a Pelagic, this is beyond. This is the time period when people were reading masculine newspapers underneath their Gemaras. And the Nesiv was sending students with issues with Amunah to Rav Cook. And Reuven Bengis said, no, he is stealing, he is looking at all this literature himself. Why are you sending students to him? The Nesiv protected Rav Cook. Unable to restrain himself, Bengis eventually stole a glance at Rav Cook's mysterious papers. What did I find? Pieces of paper handwritten with the name of God. Rav Cook was meditating on different shemos of Hashem. Velazhen was a place where there was no Kabbalah. People learned Shas and Poskim, really Gemara, basically 24/7, from Brachos through Uksin. The Nesiv was considered progressive that he introduced a once a week Chumash year on Friday mornings. That was like a big Kiddush. The Nesiv introduced a Chumash year on Friday mornings in Velazhen. The curriculum was just Gemara. And Rav Cook on the side was already meditating on shemos of Hashem. Already a stickle of a different person. After Rav Cook married, he left the Lashon, he married their daughter. He had a couple of, his first wife actually passed away after a couple of years. They had no children. She passed away, I think, after 3 years of marriage. He remarried his first wife's cousin, who was the father of their children, Rav Sarita Cook, and the daughters were products of the second marriage. Rav Cook had a couple of different smaller stellars in Europe. They were small, they gave him time to learn, they gave him time to write. During that time period, he became a Talmud Chaver of Rabbi Yosef Shalom Oyashev, the Baal HaLeshem, who was probably one of the last great Lithuanian Mekubalim. Student of a student of a student of the Vilna Gaon, a real Mekubal, somebody who published in Kabbalah, the Leshem Shabbat Ba'achlama. Rav Cook was instrumental in bringing Rabbi Yosef to Israel after Rav Cook became chief rabbi. And Rav Cook was actually Masada Kedushin at the grandson of Rabbi Yosef, just passed away a couple years ago, and he was Masada Kedushin at his wedding. Rav Cook makes Aliyah in 1904 to Yafo. He's a rabbi of Yafo of Moshavot. 1914,
he was formally invited to become the rabbi.
Yeah. He left Europe with a position waiting for him. Yafo was an interesting place because it was mixed Dati secular. The Moshavot, the Chlal, were very Zionistic, some are Dati, some are not Dati. Rav Cook meets a lot of interesting people there. 1914, Rav Cook goes back to Europe to take part in an Agudas Yisrael convention, of all things. And he gets stuck in Europe because World War I breaks out. So 1914 to 1919, he's in Europe. First, he's in Switzerland. And then he goes to England, becomes a rabbi in England. 1920, I forgot the exact date, he comes back as the officially appointed British chief rabbi of the Mandate of Palestine, who's Yerushalayim, and Yerushalayim from 1920 to 1935. Amazing. That's Rav Cook's basic storyline. So he dies pre-state, and he's there as part of the second Aliyah. I just want to keep an eye on the clock. Rav Cook is notoriously difficult to understand. His writing is extremely hard. Why? Has anybody here had a history, had tried to make heads or tails of Rav Cook? I've tried. I can't say I was successful. What are some of the difficulties?
One, the fact that the Hebrew language as a spoken language was still being redesigned at the time, and exactly. Everyone had their own ideas.
Good. Number one is the language. Rav Cook sort of developed his own version of Hebrew. We'll discuss that. Rav Cook himself writes about this. We'll see his own reflections on his language.
For Cook student, had, I think, Pumusim with Eliezer Ben
Yehuda. Yeah. His
son about things.
Yes, he has letters back and forth with Ben Yehuda. In addition, for people that generally speaking study Jewish philosophy, there is usually a clear trajectory going from earlier sources to contemporary Jewish philosophy. Rav Sadia Gaon wrote the first Jewish philosophy book, first organized Jewish philosophy book, the Munus Vadeos. The introduction is a methodological introduction. How do you do Jewish philosophy? What are my sources? What am I going to do? He tells you, these are the sources of truth. And there's Mesora, there is empirical things, there is the Sefer things, there's Pesukim, there are Gemaras. And he tells you, here's how I'm going to use all these things, and I'm going to prove to you, using these sources of truth, what my philosophical assertions are. Rav Soloveitchik, skipping 1,700 years into the, or 1,000-something years, he has a book, Halachic Mind, the first book he wrote. He tells you, this is how I'm going to do Jewish philosophy. I'm going to use these types of sources look at them in a certain type of way and get a contemporary Jewish philosophy. Rav Kook, the pieces have no context, no sources, no anything. He just throws you right in. What is a classic Rav Kook piece? This is a one-line piece, source number 3. A Rota Tshuva, a random piece. I just took it at random because it's short. But also, it's actually easy to read in terms of the words. Kol Chet, source number 3, every sin. I feel like Kal Shabbat HaTa'im, even the slightest of sins. Matzviya Bekarim Ba'adam, Sin'ah Le'ezobriya, instills within the heart of a person hatred towards some creature. By the Tshuva, Chazaret Avad Ha'er, and 22 Tshuva, you start loving everybody again. So you're thinking of this, like, what is this person talking about? Why, if I sin, if I come late to davening, I eat Basar B'chalav, then I'm going to start hating people, I'm going to start, like, stepping on ants and killing them, and all of a sudden when I do tshuva, then I'm going to, all of a sudden, be lovey-dovey with the world again? What are the sources? What's the methodology? Where did they get this from? What's the context? How does he define tshuva? These are questions which, generally speaking, philosophers who write in organized fashion are going to deal with. They give you a definition. From the definition, you have to write this. Rav Kook doesn't do that. He just throws you right in, no context, line by line by line. Yeah, Shlomo.
Part of that, I think, is the fact that I think very little of the writings of Rav Kook were actually written as organized books.
Exactly. Go, go, go. We'll get there. So the question is, why did he write in that way? What, he doesn't quote sources. He himself scribbles, and we'll discuss that in a second, scribbles his own ideas in notebooks, which are only organized by his students. It's not the normal way of Jewish philosopher doing Jewish philosophy. Normally, you think of a person in a base medrash or a library with a stack of books writing organized essays. That's the way the Rambam wrote. That's Rav Saadia wrote. That's the way people wrote. Rav Kook doesn't do that. Rav Kook spends his days carrying around kvatzim, carrying around notebooks in his pockets. His students have memoirs. They talk about this. He would be leaving a meeting with Muslim officials or British officials. All of a sudden, stop, take out a notebook, jot something down, and continue. His students talk about how sometimes he was at a meal. He would ask for a pencil, take a napkin, write on the napkin onto the table. He didn't think or write in an organized fashion. The lack of sources got him in trouble. After he published the book Oroth, which was one of the few books he himself published, the book Oroth was pretty quickly put in clear. He himself personally was not put in clear, and Rosen Chaim Zonnefeld didn't put Rav Kook in clear, and they had a good relationship, but Rosen Chaim Zonnefeld told people, do not read the book Oroth. Rav Kook's parents were still alive in Europe when the book Oroth was put in clear. And he's like, I should probably tell them that my book was put in clear before the news gets to them to avoid their opinion. So look at source number 4. This is a letter Rav Kook wrote to his parents after the Chayyarim came out in the book Oroth. It's a fascinating letter. He's like, Mom and Dad, you know, your star son, your child prodigy, biggest son of the generation. My book should just put in clear. Shut up, it's not so bad, don't worry, everything will be okay. But look what Rav Kook says. He says, Al-Zavar ha-Rognim, b'inyan Oroth. Those people that complain about the book of Oroth, ain't listen life, don't pay attention to them. This is what people do, that don't learn Hilchos Deos, they don't learn Jewish philosophy. Anything that seems like it's new, they are going to complain about. Everything I write has an ancient foundation. And it's leaving the source of holiness. Many people over the course of generations have had their books put in a playroom because people don't understand where they're coming from. The Rambam, the Ramchal, a lot of our Kook's heroes had their books put in a playroom. Look at the next underlying line. The Ba'erat and Makorot ain't to out. He's like, what's one of the complaints about my book? There are no sources. I'm going to write things like people exercising in the streets of Yerushalayim are just as kadosh as those people that are learning Torah in the Beis Medrash. He has a line like that in Oroth. That line in Oroth was put on the Pashkevilim, on the Charamim that were against Rav Kook. So Rav Kook's like, you know, maybe I should have put sources on for these radical ideas. The Varet of Makorot ain't Ta'alat. There's no purpose to quote sources. Al-Pirov, in the majority of cases, the sources are not going to get you to my formulation. They will shine a light. They will reflect some sense of this idea after you think about it and feel it out a lot. What's Rav Kook saying? The sources that he's dealing with. Rav Kook knew Kol, I should have mentioned this before. Rav Kook knew Kol HaTshuva. Shas and Poskim and the Chazon Ish told people to read Rav Kook's Tshuvos. They said Rav Kook's Tshuvos were the old style of European Tshuvos. A lot of Pilpulim, a lot of Makoros. Kook would walk around the Beis Medrash. He'd ask people what sugi they were learning, and he would tell them the sugi of Alpeh. Rav Kook's tshuvos are, you know, classic tshuvos. You wouldn't know anything else about him. You just had his tshuvos. He was a baki in rational Jewish philosophy, Rambam, Rav Saadia, and he has these sources at his fingertips. And so this person is a Bucky in this story, is a Bucky in Kabbalah. He also starts quoting from Kant and Schopenhauer and Hegel, the Western philosophers of his era and of the earlier generations. He had a lot of sources that he knew. He knew Kol HaTorah on his fingertips. He was literally a prodigy. Yet, he doesn't quote these sources, by and large, in his books, because they're not going to get you directly to his formulations. He has all these ideas running in the back of his head. He has these formulations, these sources running in the back of his head, but you don't actually, it's not a one-to-one correlation from these sources to his formulation. So it's not good, it's not worth it to quote sources. Good. So what is going on with Vivkov? Why could he not write in an organized fashion? Why does he write so lyrically, so poetically? And why is he okay with the fact that the sources don't necessarily justify all of his formulations? Again, now I'm speaking in vague, ambiguous terms. As we go on in the next three classes, next three shiurim, we'll discuss what some of the principles of the philosophy are. Now we're just discussing it in general. He's okay with saying that the sources don't necessarily justify directly everything he's saying. Vivkov is very understanding of the fact that his books were put in the theory. He's like, I recognize the fact I'm saying new things, and people are going to be upset with it. In order to understand who Vivkov was in his own self-conception, in his own words, and therefore the way he did Jewish philosophy, we have to take a little bit of a step back. What I'm going to be doing now is based on a bunch of things, but most recently there was a book written by Dr. Smadar Shurlo, and who got a PhD in Bar-Ilan and thought of Rivkov. She published her dissertation as a book called Tzadik Yisod Olam, HaMeshlichut HaMistit Shel Tzadik Miyafo. Tzadik Yisod Olam, Tzadik is the foundation of the world, the mystical secret mission of the Tzadik of Yafo of Rivkov. What she does is that for the 50 years after Rav Kook passed away, we had several books from Rav Kook. Orot, Orot HaKodesh, we had a couple of books. Everybody knew that under lock and key, in some vault in Yerushalayim, Rav Kook's original notebooks, where he jotted down all of these things, were. Nobody had access to them. People tried to pressure the people in charge of this vault to publish them, to publish a little bit of them, but for whatever reason, they decided not to publish them. In the 1980s, because of some scandal, they got published. They got published under the title Shmona Kvatzim. After Shmona Kvatzim were published, we have access to Rav Kook's original notebooks. And what was Nisgala? What did we see from Rav Kook's original notebooks? There are a lot of passages in first person, a lot of biographical passages, first person passages, where Rav Kook is trying to figure out things about himself. He writes about his own struggles, he writes about his own life. And it's understandable why people didn't want to publish these things, because this is Rav Kook's personal diary. And therefore, there is going to be a little sense of like an invasion of privacy when we look at some of these passages. But at the same time, these passages are now free on the internet. It's like you Google them, everything's free online. It's on Safaria, it's on Wikitext. Shmona Kvatzim is there, it's used. It's hard to learn Rav Kook seriously these days without making use of the original notebooks to which we now have access to. So what she points out is if you read Rav Kook's notebooks, Rav Kook had a self-conception as a tzaddik. What is a tzaddik? If anybody here is familiar with chassidus, a tzaddik, in classic Jewish literature, is a righteous person, somebody has more zechuyos than others. What is a tzaddik according to Kabbalah? What is a tzaddik according to chassidus? Is a different type of soul, a qualitatively different type of soul. If you read from the writings of the Naaman HaMelech, of the Kishas Levi, even Tanya, you'll get the sense that an average person's soul is a mixture of good and bad. Like most of us here we're probably regular souls. There are some people that are just born with a higher spiritual aptitude. There's some people that are musical prodigies. They're just born with an innate sense of music. They're mathematical prodigies. They're just born with an innate sense of math. What Chassidus and Kabbalah claims is there are some people that are just born with an innate sense of spirituality. They are born with an innate sense of God's presence, of Avas Hashem, of Yiras Hashem. These things are real for them in a way that we strive for, in a way that's difficult for the average person, but this is the reality in which the tzaddikim live. Rav Kook and Shmona Kvatzim has a lot to say about tzaddikim in general. Here's an example, source number 5. This is a random piece in Shmona Kvatzim that Rav Kook jotted down one day, walking through the streets of Yerushalayim. Rav Kook writes as follows: Hatzadikim hagedolim, the great righteous people, the great tzadikim, kolim b'nishmatam et hakol. They include everything within themselves. Yesh lahem kol hatov shel hakol. All the good that's in the world is included in their neshama. Gam kol harasha lakol. Also all the evil that occurs in the world, they feel. The sovim yisurim ba'ad hakol. They suffer because people do bad things. What's Rebbe talking about? It's like a Hasidic Rebbe, like a mother. The Hasidim, the people in the world, are intricately linked with the neshama of the tzaddik. The tzaddik feels their pain. The tzaddik feels their chatayim, feels their sins. And the more they connect to the tzaddik, the more the tzaddik davens for them, the tzaddik can elevate them. The tzaddik is not just a private individual. The tzaddik includes many different types of neshamas. Look at source number 6 for a second. We're not going to be reading every line of every piece, but let's try to highlight the main lines. Rav Kook writes as follows. Another random line about tzaddikim. Yeshnam tzaddikim. There are some tzaddikim in the world shetzmeim him ma'od that are thirsty litzgagut or lokindul vavam. They're thirsty for the light of God in their hearts. V'chafetzim him, and they desire l'hagot et Hashem b'otziyotav. What do they want to do? They want to say Yukei Vavke. I personally never had a desire in my life to pronounce Yukei Vavke. I'm not sure about you, but I've never had a desire in my life to pronounce Yukei Vavke. No, I think he means it. He means it literally. We'll see. In order to be filled with the light, the shine of the Shem Hashem. But they revert backwards. They recoil. Because they know that the world right now cannot withstand the light, the divine light, the spirituality that was present in the Beis HaMikdash, where the name Yud Kei Vav Kei was said. Again, Rav Kook is writing in general about tzaddikim, that there are these times of tzaddikim that are so connected with Hashem, it hurts them that they can't pronounce the name Yud Kei Vav Kei. Look at verse number 7. That's a third person passage. Rav Kook writes the first person. This is a totally different passage later on in the notebooks. Mechireku atzar gadol, is this great pain for not? Al she'ein ani rashai lagot et Hashem b'otzi v'sahav, that I cannot pronounce Shem Hashem, I cannot pronounce Yud Kei Vav Kei. V'chilo eish kodeshi, it's a burning fire. Hatzorevet v'yoketet v'neshama, that burns my soul. Hamora, that indicates, it teaches, for the deep gaguim, the deep yearning, the deep pining to the light of the true God, Elokei Yisrael. Shirak b'shem ha-kadosh ha-nechtav hu-meir. It only shines through the way God's name is written through Yud Kei Vav Kei. What's going on? Rav Kook writes that there are some tzaddikim, there are great mukubalim, there are great people in this world that desire to say Yud Kei Vav Kei. Who's he writing about? He's writing about himself. Rav Kook self-defined as a tzaddik. You don't have so many first-person passages in Jewish literature of people that self-define as a tzaddik. The Baal Tanya writes a lot about tzaddikim in general. Never says he's a tzaddik. Noam HaLemela writes a lot about tzaddikim in general. Never self-defines as a tzaddik. Rav Kook in his diaries is telling us he feels that God created him with a different soul. He is different. Hashem made him different. He's going to say, it's not because of his own efforts. He's going to refer to it as a matnas avokim. It's a divine gift. Some people are gifted in math. Some people are gifted in music. Some people are gifted in ruchnius, or gifted in spirituality. Rav Kook says, he is defined as a tzaddik. And therefore, if you read Hasidic literature, read Kabbalistic literature, what type of Torah are these people drawn to? What type of Torah do these people love, do these people want to be learning all day? Kabbalah. There was a long debate in this Rav Kook study in the academic world, what category to put Rav Kook in. For some people, they want to put Rav Kook as like a Western thinker. You know, he quotes Schopenhauer, quotes Hegel, quotes Kant, right? So he uses a lot of their terminology. Maybe Rav Kook should be thought of as like a 19th century Western European, Western European thinker. For some people, then they make Rav Kook into another Gadol Israel. Whatever. Rav Kook was like everybody else. He just happened to be a Zionist. It was one of the early books about Rav Kook. Was Rav Kook between rationalism and mysticism. And Rav Kook was dealing with both. Over the course of the decades, where more and more of Kook's writings have been published, it's very clear. Rav Kook self-defined as a mekubal, as a chassidic tzaddik, a chassidish tzaddik. He felt that his neshama was different. He wanted to learn Kabbalah. He was a real live mystic.
But his personal background was not the Hasidus at all.
His mother is his, but meaning he was, he drew both from Hasidic and from Lithuanian, meaning his,
yeah.
Meaning the idea of a tzaddik also exists in Lithuanian Kabbalah, Misnagdash Kabbalah, but it's less relevant there in terms of the community. But his mother was Chabad. One of the few books he says was important for him in terms of his own writing was Tanya. He cites Tanya as an important source for many of his ideas. Without telling you which lines of Tanya he drew from, just as a general, you should learn Tanya if you want to understand. If you want to understand what I'm doing. And this is one of the reasons why Rav Kook is so hard to understand. Rav Kook doesn't use traditional Hasidic or Kabbalistic terminology. He doesn't talk about the spheros so much. A little bit. He doesn't talk about the spheros so much. He doesn't talk about the olamos. He doesn't talk about tzimtzum. He uses these terms here and there. But what world is Rav Kook coming from? He's coming from a world that is secretive. Coming from a world that's esoteric. Coming from a world which is experiential. Coming from a world where, you know, it's, the whole point of Kabbalah is that it's not supposed to be spread to the masses. And so Rav Kook thought that should change in the early 20th century. But these ideas are just simply hard to express. Source number 8. Another first-person passage about Rav Kook. Mi yodea la kirosi. Kook writes in his own diaries. Who knows me? Mi yodea slavos levavi. Who knows the passion of my heart? Ha-bo'er ba'emet ve'esh avas Hashem al-yonah. That burns in truth the passion for the love of Hashem. Kalsa l'chon afshi. Li'i b'yibasar yu anu l'kalchai. Hashem, I pine for you. I desire you. Mi zeh yuchal l'hasid. Who can understand? I cannot become interested, I cannot focus on any limited thing. It was my great desire for the delight of the world. For the breath of infinity. In sof is the way Mukabalam referred to Hashem. I'm lovesick. What's your cook saying? Rav Kook wrote shubos. Rav Kook dealt with politics. He dealt with day-to-day affairs with British officials, with Muslim officials, Arab officials, he tried to run a yeshiva, he tried to start a political party. Many of these ventures were failed. But he tried. What's he saying? It's very difficult for him to focus on anything specific. Why? What does he want to be doing all day?
Contemplating the infinite.
Contemplating the infinite. Pshuto kemashmo. That's why this is one of the most, Rav Kook is such a captivating person, even for not a Zionist. We have first-person passages of somebody who was a real tzaddik, or real mekubal. He didn't know anybody else would be reading these passages. This was his own personal notebooks. He told his students not to publish first-person passages. They were published 50 years after he died, I think, like when the gag order was over. But you had access to the neshama of somebody who felt, who lived with God as a living reality. Rav Kook's major students were attracted to him, not mostly. But their initial attraction to him wasn't because of his intellectual rigor, wasn't because of the Zionism, wasn't because of the philosophy Shabo, wasn't because of his sitkos. The Nazir, who was one of his main students that edited a lot of his works, heard Rav Kook davening, heard Rav Kook saying the Akedah, and he writes, the Nazir wrote in his own diary, in that moment, I knew I found my Rebbe. Rav Yaakov Moshe Kalab, who was one of the, from Yeshiva Yashar, he was an old Yerushalmi. Yaakov Moshe Kalab, was considered a gaon in the old Yerushalmi community. He was giving a shiur in Yeshiva Eitz Chaim at like age 18 or something. How did he become a student or a student of Rav Kook? He was sent by the doctors to Yafo because he had breathing issues, and the air in Yafo was cleaner than the air in Yerushalayim. I don't know why.
Once upon a time.
Once upon a time, I don't know. He was sent to Yafo to chill out a little bit, to relax. He was there for Shavuos. He heard Rav Kook singing Abdamas. He's like, that's the person I have to connect to. Rav Kook's students were mainly attracted to him because of the charisma, the spirituality, the personality. There was something different about him. And we're going to see the intellectual sophistication, the makoros, it's all there. But at the heart of hearts is Kabbalah, and the heart of hearts is this experience. You get a sense of why Rav Kook had trouble writing, why Rav Kook had trouble articulating his own philosophy, articulating his own thoughts. Source number 10. Let's skip number 9. He uses the passage where Kook himself self-defines as somebody who primarily is involved with Kabbalah. Imani, source number 10. Imani hineni b'tzivi. If I, by my nature, baal agadah baal mistorin, I like agadata and I like mistorin, I like secret things. Ineni tzarek l'kanos. I don't have to be jealous. Kokach, I don't have to be jealous of the fact those people that are know all of Shas, they know all of Halacha. He knew Allah, but he's against, you see his inner struggle. He's like, I feel like I have an obligation to learn Gemara, to learn Poskim. He was a Rav Rashi, he was a Poskim. But he's like, I recognize the fact that I'm holding in Gemara as I should be. He's going through his own feelings, but why not? But I shouldn't be jealous of those people that know all of Shas, because my chilek is Agarata and Misturin. And he's like, I have to learn Gemara also. It's not for naught. Hashem gave me talents in Nigla, in Shas Poskim. But I have to know myself. So I shouldn't get depressed. I shouldn't get sad. So the fact that I don't know Shas, I don't know Poskim, I don't know Nigla as well as I should. You see Rav Kook's inner thoughts, you see Rav Kook's self-defining as a Baal Nisturin, as a Mekobo. It goes even further. Rav Yisrael that Rav Kook, we'll talk about writing styles in a minute. In Rav Kook's letter to his parents, he was discussing how quoting sources in his philosophical writings are not like his thing to do. Because the sources don't create a one-to-one correlation with what he actually writes on the page. So what's going on in his brain? What is the process through which he reads the Medrash? He reads this line from the Zohar, and he gets a formulation in one of his books. So there's one passage. Again, this is a take it or leave it type of thing. I was highly skeptical of the entire idea of tzaddik, of like somebody that's on a higher spiritual level. I try to be skeptical about such things. But until I started reading Rav Kook's diaries. Because here you have somebody who is writing in first person about himself. And like all this stuff is coming alive. This is the way he self-defines. Source number 11 is a crazy, crazy passage. Let's take it or leave it. Rav Kook writes as follows. No, let's do this properly. Let's turn to the next page for a second. Source number 11, where the lines are where the font is the regular size. In Arot HaKodesh, is one of the books that was published during Rav Kook's lifetime. The piece published there starts with the following lines: Sfichei nevuot hinan tzomkot. The sprouts of prophecy are growing. Uvenei nevi'im mitzorim. The children of prophets are awakening. Ruach hanevuah holeik b'shat ha'aretz. The spirit of prophecy is coming back into the world. The vacational neflat is seeking refuge. The rational giborim, it is looking for heroes. Milei izuz v'kodesh, who are filled with might and holiness. Him yidu l'kalkel davar. Ketlan yitol yagidu. They will tell the truth. And they're not going to be scared. They're going to realize they are receiving the sprouts of prophecy. They're going to speak the truth to the people. That's what this piece is about. So that the published piece in Arot HaKodesh, which was published in his own lifetime, starts over here. What's Rav Kook talking about? Together with the return of Am Yisrael to Eretz Yisrael, Kook didn't just see a physical return, he saw a spiritual return, going back to Tkufas HaNeviim. And therefore, together with the physical return and the emergence of the society and the civilization of Jews in Eretz Yisrael, there's going to be a spiritual return, it's going to be the return of Nevuah. And that's something we'll be discussing. The Zionism isn't just a particular point, Jewish sovereignty, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, Trumas and Yisrael's. The return of Am Yisrael to Eretz Yisrael is a major fulcrum in the entire spiritual history of the world. That's the way the piece was published. Third-person piece about Nevuah return. Once Rav Kook's diaries, the Kvatzim, were published, look back at the beginning of source number 11. You realize why the first two lines weren't published. Rav Kook writes as follows. V'akshiv ne'eshna. And I listen, I'm attentive. Mitol ma'amatei nishmati. From the depths of my soul. Mitol v'kshei levavi. From the emotions of my heart. Kol Adonai korei. The voice of God is calling out. V'acharad, I was scared. Charadah gedolah, this is Parsha. I was scared, a great scare. Hakacha yarati, have I fallen so far? Ki l'navi sheker ayah, I was a false, I'm a false prophet. Leimor, Hashem shalachani, v'lo nigla alay d'var Adonai, to say that Hashem sent me, but these ideas aren't coming from God, I'm just making them up. V'eshma kol nishmati homer, and I hear the sound of my neshama stirring. The sprouts of prophecy are emerging, they're coming back, and they're looking for people to recognize this and to accept it. What's going on? Rav Kook realized what he was saying were new. What he was saying weren't necessarily, we're going to see, the sources are there. The intellectual history is there. But Rav Kook realized he had new formulations. He was saying things that had never yet been said before, based on earlier sources, but new formulations. He's struggling with the sources of his new ideas. Is it Kol Hashem? Obviously, he didn't think it was a full-blown prophet. It wasn't sound like somebody doesn't listen to him.
He's trying to make up his mind whether is this prophecy or not.
Is it, yeah, or is it some type of prophecy? It's probably not a full-blown prophet.
Say that a Navi, when he has prophecy, he has no doubt no doubt. Prophecies, and here he doesn't have that no doubt.
1,000%. No, I don't think anybody thinks Rav Kook thought of himself as a full-blown Navi, but some shtickle Ruach HaKodesh, some divine revelation, is something that Rav Kook himself is struggling to identify in this piece. Are my new ideas coming from this divine revelation, this, you know, Kabbalistic intuition, Ruach HaKodesh, or are they coming from my own imagination? In which case, I shouldn't be sharing them with the public, and I shouldn't be telling people that this is what we should be doing with our lives in the early 20th century if I'm making these ideas up. And he's struggling. He doesn't know. And what's the conclusion of this particular piece?
It started.
And we're not going to have to be as tied to the sources. I'm going to be doing things differently. We're going to shift emphases.
It connects to the later on. Because then the rest of it is, and one day there'll be Nevi'im who will not be afraid and won't be have any doubts and will be able to stand up and say it.
Exactly. Now it's beginning slowly. It's teetering. It's coming back into the world. The Nevi'im themselves spoke about the return of the book. So we're at the beginning of the time when that prophecy is being fulfilled, but we're still at the beginning. We have to slowly train ourselves to think more prophetically, think in more Ruchni terms, on a mass scale, and then we're going
to
see.
I would also turn to those first two lines. They're written in the first person.
Yes.
They're not just written in the first person. They're written in a biblical style.
Yes.
Something different from his usual style.
Okay.
The Va'akshi Va'ishvayat, it's very reminiscent of Sifrei Nevuah. The future tense used as a past tense, and
I hear that. Yeah, the Papa Hebrew.
It's deliberately biblical.
I like that. Thank you.
In the style.
Thank you, Shlomo. I appreciate the points. I wasn't sensitive to that myself when I was going through it. So thank you. So you realize why Rav Kook was in enough trouble as it was without declaring himself a false prophet, any prophet in the same piece. Which is why the first couple of lines were excised out and published from the published books. But now we have access to the original diaries, and this is what I'm going to say. Good. So how does this relate to writing style? Now, Kook has a lot of passages describing how Asma Kobol, who has a vision of the future, who is dealing with a lot of intuition, with the tons of sources all coming together, he has a very difficult time expressing his ideas in regular prose, in regular prepositional sentences, in regular organized essays. He has a couple of organized essays. He published articles, he published pieces of newspapers, a couple of longer essays, but by and large, his pieces are these short little pieces. Look at source number 12. This is one of the places where Kook describes his own difficulty in writing. For the next 5 minutes, we're going to go through with Kook admitting his own difficulty in writing, and go through different strategies he took to be able to express his ideas in one way, shape, or form, and then we'll conclude for tonight. Rav Kook writes as follows: Nechalim gedolim ishtafkim delvavi. Great rivers are pouring out of my heart. Mayanot gedolim nechkevei yadayim nitzalkim lefanai. Great springs, wide springs, are open before me. Hatorah v'amitzvos zorasayim. Torah mitzvos amlayit. Cholchim u'mitzvikim alay et zor kaveihem. Torah mitzvos, all these things are shining on me. Etc., etc., because I am sensing God. Look at the bolded parts. Source number 12. Hakol mitztayer lefanai. Everything is pictured before me. B'shitah shleima mufaket. With a complete and shining system. I have a system. Some people thought Rav Kook didn't have a system of thought. He was like a religious poet, like Yishai Ribo. Yishai Ribo is a great person, I'm sure it's a big tzaddik. I don't know if he is bringing a new religious philosophy into the world. He's a beautiful poet. He's a beautiful songwriter. Some people thought that's what Rav Kook was as well. A beautiful religious poet, a beautiful religious songwriter. Rav Kook himself is saying, I have a shita. I have an approach. It's a new approach. There are principles. There are derivatives. There's a whole philosophy and about how to live life today. Sfatai katsara v'ayefa. But my lips are too narrow, too tired. Nigavot ayada to reveal through them Even in the end, you are not orachayim ruchaniyim. From the pleasantness of the light, spiritual light, from a limit called kirbi, that fills me on the inside. Rav Kook had difficulty. It's like a nevuah. Navi sees a picture. He has to depict the picture in terms, in writing. It's a difficult transition. Rav Kook is saying he has the same difficulty. So what strategies did he employ? So it's number 13. Strategy number one. Yotzer tov, it's better, lefanai, for me. Nidalot gargurei orot shabrakim. To draw out small seeds of lightning. Minyot marich b'tzeirim mishulavim. From being marich with long formulations. Habrakim, the lightning bolts, v'im mitoh hazor p'nimi shan shaman. They come from the inner soul, the tibi yotzah, in its natural form. What's strategy number one? What's he going to do? He's going to get an inspiration, he's going to get an idea, and just write it down. It's not going to be thought out, it's not going to be sourced, it's not going to be developed. He's going to say something very, very short, very brief, and he's just going to put it there on paper. Which makes your book very beautiful, very accessible to a degree, because the pieces are often shorter. But at the same time, it's extremely frustrating. Because in order to understand what he thought about any topic, we have to take a lot of these pieces and put them all together. Because each time, you're just getting like one angle of it. So that's strategy number one, is just getting an inspiration, writing it out in short pieces without not longer essays. Strategy number two, source number 14. Hegyanotai, my thoughts, hinam minei yom yachabim. They're like a wide sea. B'safat prazit, nabiyam ba'machoga. I cannot express them in prose. Prazit is prose. Shelo b'tovati, it's against my, it's not in my betterment, it's to my deficiency. Hineni muhrach liot mishorer. I have to be a poet. What's the difference between poetry and prose? Prose gives you facts. Poetry is the best way to create a picture in one's mind through words. So Rav Kook is saying, I have a picture in my mind, I have an image, I have a vision, which I want to express. I can't express it in prepositional sentences. I can't say, the Zohar says X, and therefore you should do Y, but it's not going to capture what the vision is. I have to describe things poetically, I have to describe things in song, which is why Rav Kook writes so lyrically. So number 15, third strategy. Anid sarek ladaber habe odot atzmi. You've seen this already. Kook says, I have to write a lot about myself. In yoni atzmiyuti, my own essence, muhrachim litzvarer li habe ma'od. I have to understand myself. We're going to see echoes of this in his thought. But when atin atzmi, when I understand myself, avin atakol. I'm going to say everything. And so olam etzachayim, the world of life, adam ga'al ha'binah l'makar ha'chayim, and so it's the Kabbalistic combination, and so bina reaches the source of life. Now Kook is writing autobiographically. Even passages that are in third person, which is statements of fact, are often autobiographical. If you read a Rota Tshuva, he says, when somebody does Tshuva, this is what they feel. And it's like, I don't feel that when I do Tshuva. Rav Kook was probably writing autobiographically. They're like, this is the way I feel when I do Tshuva. And it's connected with the system, connected with the philosophy, it's connected with his conception of Tshuva, but he's writing from personal experience. So these are three strategies that Kook took in order to best capture his ideas. Number one, he's going to capture his thoughts in short formulations. Number two, he's going to write poetically, not in prose. And number three, he's going to write autobiographically, as opposed to looking at sources and writing out what he said, and writing out what he thinks the sources are saying. So that makes for an extremely attractive moshach. It's the right reading of Kook. If you get past the initial problems of the Hebrew, it's very poetic. It's very attractive. It's moshach. You know, it's something which is beautiful. It's something which, you know, it brings tears to people's eyes in ways that reading Rav Seidenbaum often doesn't. But at the same time, it can be extremely, extremely frustrating. Because you read a piece, and it's like, it sounds amazing, it sounds beautiful, but like, what in the world did he just say? And why in the world did he just say that? So you have to deal with both sides when you're reading Rav Kook, both the experiential side, and get the flavor of what he's trying to say, but then you have to go back and deal with the intellectual history and figure out what is he saying and why is he saying it. The last piece is number 16, and this is Rav Kook's sort of putting things together, and then we'll conclude with this. It's like a programmatic statement. This is what I'm going to be trying to do in my own writing. Kook writes as follows. Source number 16. Lo lechinam. It's not for naught. Not for naught. Natabi el kafan afashot. That God, the master of all souls, and the chukat diritachon istar, placed in me a desire for everything hidden. L'chol ne'atzal v'nisgav. For everything aristocratic, everything elevated, for Kabbalah. V'lo l'chinam, it's not for naught. Hevi'ani l'aretz Yisrael. Hashem brought me to Israel. V'lo l'chinam yatzar bi ruach ometz v'torah panimi. It's not for naught that God created me with his inner purity. Look at the bolded part. What mission does he have because of the way God created him? Kol ila natu b'kirbi. All these things were implanted within me. To use them to give light to the world, the tzur sifrut, to create a literature, milaya or vaze Torah, that's filled with the light of the secrets of the Torah, that's filled with Kabbalistic secrets, popularity, that's popular, mishavel lachonakesh, and accessible to people. We're going to see one of the major things Rav Kook is going to do is take Kabbalistic Hasidic ideas that were esoteric, they were there for the elite. And say, now in this generation, everybody has to know them. We have to start living by them. Think about the ramifications. Think about what they mean for day-to-day life. And you're going to see, it's going to give you a different flavor of life in Eretz Israel. This writing, this literature, has to be filled with song and might. But still, here's also a line. But it's going to be girded. It's going to be armored with seichel tov, with also logic, rational learning. We'll be and faithful criticism, faithful critical thinking. The Harim Karen Am Hashem, to lift up the horn, lift up the pride of Hashem's nation, the Tshuat Olam, for the salvation of the world, Shehechila L'Zerachlo B'Eretz Yisrael, that is beginning now in the land of Israel. Rav Kook gave himself, again, he put himself into a role in the Messianic process, in the Geula process. That Hashem created me in this way, gave me all this knowledge, gave me this inner purity, gave me these desires to guide Am Yisrael, to create a literature that is filled with Kabbalistic secrets, but still with rational thought, and that's practical and popular and esoteric and experiential and intellectual all at the same time, in order to help the Geula process unfold, in order to help accelerate, to teach people how they're supposed to live as Mashiach comes closer. So again, the sort of we didn't do any actual makshava or Rav Kook this week. I just feel like this is a necessary background before we look at Rav Kook, just to see who he was, where he's coming from. He's not your average gadol, I guess, in many of these ways. And God willing, next week, for those who are interested, we'll be meeting again. I think we'll be talking about Rav Kook's conception of Jewish history. He has a couple of different essays where he goes through Jewish history from a couple of different angles. And they all stream in to, like, here's my understanding of the current moment as Jews are returning to Eretz Israel, and this is what we have to do in the current moment, different than what we did for the last couple of generations, in order to help the history move forward. Sounds very large and grandiose, but we'll see, it's extremely practical and down to earth in the end of the day. Yeah.
Just a question, are we later in the series going to get into exactly what Rav Kook actually published and why those specific things, or do you want to give us like a little overview of what was published by Rav Kook versus what was then gathered?
Good. We could do it right now if you're interested.
Yeah. Should I keep this going? Or?
I think it's okay.
Okay.
I think we published. So Rav Kook himself, and if anybody wants to go, we can go.